Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. So looking at the Associated Press urgent wire, AP news alert, just in, 3 minutes ago. It's one line. You think this is going to be really big. And it says, Obama announces debt-cutting plan that would raise taxes on rich. Well, it's no surprise. We knew it was coming. We talked about the Buffett rule and what it's supposed to imply last hour. We'll talk about it more now and dig a little bit deeper. That's the one-line version. AP, Obama announces debt-cutting plan that would raise taxes on rich. It is a big thing. It's just that it was expected. We all knew it was coming. And here it comes as an AP news alert. Oh, my God, is there an earthquake? Is there a hurricane? Did a plane crash? Obama announces tax-cutting plan or deficit-cutting plan that would raise taxes on rich. A little more fleshed out from Reuters from last hour, where they say President Obama will lay out a plan today, as he's doing right now, he's speaking right now, to cut the U.S. deficit that will raise taxes on the rich, striking a populist tone to motivate his Democratic Party base before the November 2012 election. He will vow to veto any cuts proposed for the government-run Medicare health program for the elderly unless Congress agrees to lift taxes on companies and the wealthy. That is, to raise taxes on companies and the wealthy. Of course, that's what's getting all the headlines. Most of this $3 trillion debt reduction plan is actually in government spending cuts. Less than half of it would be in these tax hikes. So let's start talking about it, and then we'll hear from the president momentarily with the New York Times Washington Bureau Chief and former economics columnist David Leonhardt. Hi, David. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Good morning.
And congratulations on your new job as Washington Bureau Chief.
Thank you.
I want to ask you about later. But first, let's listen together to a little of the president from just a minute or two ago. He laid out his commitment to Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and other long-term spending reductions. But he also has laid out some revenue-generating plans under the Buffett rule, as he calls it, which means seven-figure earners, people who actually earn $1 million in a year, should be forced to pay as much as people in the middle class. So here's a little of President Obama from just a few minutes ago.
So this is how we can reduce spending: by scouring the budget for every dime of waste and inefficiency, by reforming government spending, and by making modest adjustments to Medicare and Medicaid. But all these reductions in spending by themselves will not solve our fiscal problems. We can't just cut our way out of this hole. It's going to take a balanced approach. If we're going to make spending cuts, many of which we wouldn't make if we weren't facing such large budget deficits, then it's only right that we ask everyone to pay their fair share. You know, last week, Speaker of the House, John Boehner, gave a speech about the economy. And to his credit, he made the point that we can't afford the kind of politics that says it's my way or the highway. I was encouraged by that. Here's the problem. In the same speech, he also came out against any plan to cut the deficit that includes any additional revenues whatsoever. He said, I'm quoting him, there is only one option. And that option, and only option, relies entirely on cuts. That means slashing education, surrendering the research necessary to keep America's technological edge in the 21st century, and allowing our critical public assets like highways and bridges and airports to get worse. It would cripple our competitiveness and our ability to win the jobs of the future. And it would also mean asking sacrifice of seniors and the middle class and the poor, while asking nothing of the wealthiest Americans and biggest corporations. So the Speaker says we can't have it my way or the highway, and then basically says my way or the highway. That's not smart. It's not right. If we're going to meet our responsibilities, we have to do it together. Now, I'm proposing real serious cuts in spending. When you include the $1 trillion in cuts I've already signed into law, these would be among the biggest cuts in spending in our history. But they've got to be part of a larger plan that's balanced.
So President Obama speaking just a few minutes ago, and David Leonhardt, Washington Bureau Chief for the New York Times. What's new here? Because this is the same speech that the president has been giving for months and months through rounds of various budget negotiations and debt ceiling negotiations on shared sacrifice, on the need to cut government spending, but as part of that bargain, raise some revenues on the part of those from the people who can most afford it, rather than solely doing it with cuts that would hurt so many people, he says. So what's new today?
There's a larger and a smaller answer, I think. The Buffett rule is new. It's not new today. It's new. We had it on our website late Saturday, so it's new in the last 2 days.
That's the news person's definition of old, something that's a day and a half ago.
Yes. So we can talk a little bit more about the Buffett rule if you want. It's interesting. But let's start with the larger thing that's new here, which is, I think, the approach. What Obama has been looking for really all along, it's very much his nature, is the big compromise. He and John Boehner, the House Speaker, whom he was talking about at length there, essentially agreed to the big compromise. And it was actually a compromise that was quite favorable to Republicans. As a quick check, it was to the right of the plan proposed by the Bowles-Simpson Deficit Commission, which I think a lot of liberals felt was maybe a little bit too far right anyway. So the Boehner-Obama compromise was quite conservative in certain ways. Basically, the only tax increases on the affluent it included in terms of dollar amounts were the tax increases, were getting rid of the Bush tax cuts for income above $250. Boehner was unable to sell that compromise to his caucus, and so that deal fell apart during the debt ceiling. And what we now see then is Obama essentially stepping back and saying, okay, I am not going to come out with a plan that looks like a compromise. I am going to come out with a plan that is very much a Democratic plan. It raises taxes on the wealthy. It cuts both domestic spending and military spending. It has some cuts to Medicare, but it almost entirely avoids touching Social Security. And it avoids the big changes to Medicare that he had agreed to in that deal with Boehner, like raising the retirement age. And so this is basically Obama moving back from the, I want to come out with a compromise and try to make the compromise work, and saying, hey, the Republicans don't want a compromise right now. And so I'm going to come out with a plan that's closer to what I would actually want if I could do whatever I wanted. And so what we now have is an Obama plan, and we have a Republican plan, neither of which looks like a compromise that you can imagine getting passed, really in the short or the medium or even longer term.
And this, in effect, is the president's recommendations to the deficit reduction super committee. People remember the debt ceiling agreement in the summer and how contentious that was, and they kicked the ball down the road on most of the big decisions there to this bipartisan so-called super committee with members of both parties from members of both houses of Congress that's supposed to come up with recommendations by Thanksgiving, on which Congress will have to give a straight up or down vote. So the White House now, today, trying to influence the super committee, produces this plan. And David, let me tick off just a few of the particulars, some of the number headlines from this. $4.4 trillion in deficit reduction. That's a larger number than we thought it was going to be from the earlier reporting. The big Obama-Boehner grand bargain that almost got through was also $4 trillion. So this is big. And $1.2 trillion of it would come from the cuts to various discretionary programs, as they're called, the various domestic programs that are not Medicare or Medicaid or Social Security, enacted in the last round, a half a trillion dollars in cuts from reforms to a wide range of mandatory programs. I want you to explain that to me in a minute, because I think that's where Medicare and Medicaid recipients might start to feel the hit. $1 trillion from the drawdown of troops in Afghanistan and Iraq. $1.5 trillion from tax reform. I guess that's the tax changes, including hikes that we're talking about. and another $430 billion in additional interest savings. So these big ticket items, $1.5 trillion from tax reform, $0.5 trillion in cuts and reforms to a wide range of mandatory programs. Now, when we say mandatory programs, are we talking overwhelmingly about Medicare?
Well, is that all the mandatory programs, or is that the non-Medicare mandatory programs?
It's not clear to me.
So I haven't looked enough at the numbers to be able to be sure off the top of my head. But often these mandatory programs, that does mean Medicare, but often when people are making these proposals, they call Medicare Medicare or entitlement programs. And the mandatory often falls under an other mandatory title that includes things like farm subsidies. It includes things sometimes like military health care. So I'm not sure which the $500 billion there applies mm-hmm. to. But the important thing here is that mandatory isn't just Medicare. It's also things like farm subsidies.
What would he propose with respect to Medicare in this plan, if it's clear enough yet? Because I feel like I'm hearing headline coverage that's saying both contradictory things. The president, like that Reuters story that I read,
right.
Obama will vow to veto any cuts proposed for the government-run Medicare health program for the elderly unless Congress agrees to lift taxes, raise taxes on companies and the wealthy. So that would make it sound like
his Medicare cuts are focused more on providers, which is to say hospitals and doctors and
right.
nurses.
Right.
And so what this is it's less saying that it's not saying, hey, if you're 66, you can't get Medicare anymore. It's more saying that Medicare is going to pay less in some areas than it's now paying. The short version of the argument for that approach would be that doctors in this country make significantly more by any good analysis than doctors almost anywhere else. Our healthcare system is vastly larger as a share of our economy than anywhere else. There seems to be some room to cut healthcare provider payments. The brief con argument would be, well, if you start cutting Medicare even more and you create an even larger gap between what Medicare pays and what the private market pays, you're going to have more doctors dropping out of Medicare, and it's going to become harder for people on Medicare to actually find doctors. But the scale of these cuts are to Medicare, they're not nothing, but they're not the sort of overhaul in any way of Medicare. And part of that, a big part of that, is political here. The Republicans, by agreeing to the Paul Ryan plan to, it's the semantics here, radically overhaul or eliminate Medicare, depending on your view, have created some political vulnerability for themselves, many Democrats believe. And so the House and Senate Democrats were eager to have Obama minimize the kind of Medicare cuts he's going to propose because they very much want to run against the Republicans in 2012. As wanting to cut Medicare. And so the less they come out for in terms of cutting Medicare, the harder it is for the Republicans right. to respond, hey, we're all for cutting Medicare. It's just a matter of how and how much.
And here's that number now, as I see it in one of these releases. The president's plan does propose $250 billion in cuts to Medicare.
So the 500 is the other mandatory?
The 580 includes the 250.
Okay.
And other things.
So 330 and other mandatory. That scale-wise, that makes sense. So the 330 is things like farm subsidies. And some parts of government, it's not entirely clear what's mandatory. To an outsider, it wouldn't be clear what's mandatory and what's not. Some programs that seem as if they should be mandatory, like
yes.
Pell Grants, where there's a formula, are not, in fact, mandatory. But then other programs like farm subsidies are mandatory.
But nevertheless, we have Obama saying he's going to cut Medicare and then running against the Republicans because they would cut Medicare.
Well, there is, whether you think he's right or wrong, that is not a crazy thing to do. There is a vast difference in the scale of these cuts. I mean, what Obama's talking about is tinkering around the edges. What the Republicans are talking about is replacing the Medicare that we have with a new program
right.
that would still be called Medicare, but would be completely different, in which senior citizens would have to get insurance on the private market. And so I think objectively we can say quite comfortably that there is a vast difference between what they're mm-hmm. proposing and then leave for the political arena to fight over which is better.
Right. Here's another minute of the president from a few moments ago.
Warren Buffett's secretary shouldn't pay a higher tax rate than Warren Buffett. There's no justification for it. It is wrong that in the United States of America, a teacher or a nurse or a construction worker who earns $50,000 should pay higher tax rates than somebody pulling in $50 million. Anybody who says we can't change the tax code to correct that? Anyone who has signed some pledge to protect every single tax loophole so long as they live? They should be called out. They should have to defend that unfairness. Explain by somebody who's making $50 million a year in the financial markets should be paying 15% on their taxes, when a teacher making $50,000 a year is paying more than that, paying a higher rate. They ought to have to answer for that. And if they're pledged to keep that kind of unfairness in place, they should remember the last time I checked, the only pledge that really matters is the pledge we take to uphold the Constitution.
President Obama, from a few minutes ago, announcing his $4.4 trillion debt reduction plan, including the principle of the Buffett rule, which basically, David Leonhardt, New York Times Washington Bureau chief, would raise the capital gains tax rate from 15%, that privileged lower rate, to whatever your income tax rate is. And we heard the president explain why he thinks that would be fair. But beyond the fairness question, we had a spirited discussion last hour with New York's new Republican Congressman Bob Turner, who says, look, fairness aside, you just are going to create more jobs with this 15% capital gains tax because investors are going to find it more in their interest to take those risks.
I think everyone agrees that if you hold all things equal, I'm sure everyone doesn't, but if you hold, most people agree, if you hold all things equal, lower tax rates are better for employment than higher ones. But there is, but all things aren't equal, and the fact is that we have a huge deficit right now, and we can't keep going the way we're going, and cutting spending also has impacts on employment. And so any kind of deficit cuts, whether it's tax increases or spending cuts, is in the short term going to present some risk to the job market. I think the thing that anyone who makes that argument needs, that basically tax increases are the worst thing we could do for jobs, they need to grapple with the following 20-year history that we've just gone through. Clinton raised his taxes. Everyone says it's going to be disastrous for the economy. Who opposed it? I mean, some of the quotes you can scare up from Larry Kudlow are priceless. We then have the 90s, which were this incredible decade of growth. Bush cuts taxes. The people advocating for that say this is going to lead to a great boom, and instead we have the slowest economic growth that we've had of any decade since World War II, followed by a terrible financial crisis. Bush's tax cuts didn't cause the slow growth or the financial crisis, and Clinton's tax increases didn't cause the boom, but they obviously didn't prevent them either. Yeah. And so, to me, I find that argument, I'm much more interested in that argument when people grapple with that, rather than just making it as a talking point that that just doesn't isn't consistent with the last 20 years.
We have, I know you got to go in a minute. Your new role, I just want to ask you about moving from columnist to editor.
Yes.
This is the first time you're on with us since moving from economics columnist to Washington bureau chief. So does this mean the main part of your job over the next couple of days will be to make sure people spell Buffett with two T's?
It's funny. I tweeted about it on Saturday and wrote the tweet, saved it in drafts, and then went and confirmed whether it was spelled with one or two T's. I hope that's not the main part of my job. No, the main part of my job is to be talking with colleagues here, both editors and reporters, about the kind of stories we should be writing this week and much beyond this week. And I'm really excited about it. I mean, it is very different from my old job.
And what about what you give up? Because as a columnist, you get to state your opinions, you know, put things in context for readers directly. Oh, there's another David Leonhardt economic scene column. I really learned from those columns, and I'm really interested in his opinion, even if I don't always agree with him. Now you're behind the scenes.
Thank you. Yeah, I do give up something, and I liked my old job a lot. But I don't want to do one thing for the next 30 years. And this was just too good of an opportunity, both to work with colleagues, to play a bigger role in what the Times does, and to broaden my own horizons beyond economics, as broad as economics is, and to be working in our coverage of foreign policy. And Jill Abramson, who, as I'm sure most of your listeners know, is the new executive editor of the Times, has been very clear in encouraging me to continue writing. I had a short piece in Sunday's paper. I had a longer piece about 10 days ago, and so I won't be writing every week, but I will be continuing to write. It's going back to an older model of Washington bureau chief that was actually the norm in the past with Johnny Apple and his predecessors, in which the bureau chief was both an editor and a writer.
Well, congratulations, and I look forward to the work coming out of D.C. with David Leonhardt in charge of the Bureau now. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brian. I appreciate that.
Coming up next, some of the roots of today's Middle East situation with historian Andrew Scott Cooper. This also is about the U.S. economy in its way. His new book, The Oil Kings, recalls a time when the U.S. was actually encouraging Iran to raise the price of oil and start a nuclear program, by the way. And we'll see what the effects were back then in the 1970s and how it set up our conditions today. Stay with us.